when folks were admirals, became admirals, when people would say, hey, what's the difference between a two-star general and a three-star general? And the simple answer is solutions. As a two-star general, you have your job, you do what you do, and a lot of times you're defining the problem and how you need more money, people, or time to do the job. You're usually out in the field. Now, the three-star has to come up with solutions. They are generally the CFO. They are generally the head of logistics, the head of personnel. They got to come up with solutions for what those two-star is defining.
Welcome to Self-Equity, the podcast that dives into the inspiring journeys of founders, entrepreneurs, athletes, and entertainers. I'm your host, Jolene Tepedino, authorized officer and team business manager for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group at UBS. Welcome back to episode 28 of the Self-Equity podcast. Today, we're joined by Admiral Greener, the 30th Chief of Naval Operations. Admiral Greener has spent decades leading with integrity, strategy, and resilience. His career is a masterclass in discipline, service, and transformation. Today, we'll explore how those same principles apply to building equity in both life and in business. Joining me as co-host today is Jordan Zellniger, Wealth Strategy Associate for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group. Admiral, for us, it's an honor to have you on the Self-Equity podcast today. Your career in the Navy is nothing short of extraordinary. From serving as Chief of Naval Operations to shaping national defense strategy. Today, we're exploring how the principles of military leadership translate into business success. And Admiral, thank you for your service.
That's so kind of you. That means a lot. People today, if I may, feel that, you know, it's said too much, and I feel awkward saying it because we've been doing this for a long time. Thank you for your service. But for your listeners, I would tell you, when you say that in the airport or you say it down the street and somebody in uniform, it is a shot of adrenaline and gives them that feeling that the public does appreciate what I'm doing. They're not looking for it. It's kind of a free boost for them that you give. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right. Let's start with your journey. What inspired you to pursue a career in the Navy? And what were some of the defining moments that shaped your leadership philosophy over the years?
So I came from a blue collar background, Western Pennsylvania. My dad was a steel worker, and he sat me down one time about eighth grade. And he said, you know, son, these grades are not going to cut it. You won't get into college with these. And I'm out of money because your older sisters went to nursing school. So either you figure out a way to get these fixed and get yourself scholarship, grant, whatever, or you'll be working at the mill with me and I can get you in. You know, he was a foreman and all that. And I said, oh my, I don't want to do that. I have to get out of town. So how do I get out of town? I had a good guidance counselor and she brought me two options. And one of them was a service academy. So I looked at West Point and I looked at the Naval Academy. And by the way, the Vietnam War was going on. It was trending down now and it was close to being over, but there was still a draft. I didn't want to get drafted, go into the Army, go die in Vietnam. So simply put, I said, if I go to the Naval Academy, I pay it back in, it was 4 years at the time. I get a free education. I get a college degree. That's what I wanted in engineering. And then I go out and make money.
Was the transition point when you decided, okay, I'm going to stick with this for the long term?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Frankly, it was my wife and I. So I graduated. I went into nuclear submarines. Submariners get $100 extra a month, which was, you know, in 1980, that was something. So anyway, I was on my way there. I met my now wife about 6 months before I was going to leave the Navy. And she was getting into the Navy. She was a school teacher. And she said, there's no money in this, so I'm going to go do this. And it gave me pause, but it didn't stop me. Simply put, I went to sea for what was supposed to be a month and a half. It turned out to be 6 months. We were put on what's called operational hold. So some job offers that I had, they didn't show up and I couldn't email them. There wasn't a such thing. I couldn't call them. I was under the water. By the time I came back, we pulled into Australia. I phoned the two companies. One was Michigan and the other one was a company in Newark that makes ceramics. And they said, you didn't show up. So I had no job and I stayed for the old saying, one more tour, 2 more years. I went back to Hawaii. I got together with my wife, now wife, girlfriend then. We fell in love, got married. And she said, I kind of like this idea of being a nomad, going for 2 years here, 2 years there. We got a raise very quickly after that. The Reagan administration came in. There's no draft. There's none of that. It wasn't at that point, but I said, this is a noble venture in a way. It is paid well enough for me to be able to make a living, if you will, and raise a family, which is all I was really sort of after. And then I had really good bosses, and that made quite a bit of difference. It got more exciting and more interesting to me and my family.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there that I'm interested in. You talk about the financial side of things, right? You stuck around, the raises kept coming. What does somebody in the Navy make financially, and what does a raise look like for someone in the Navy? I think most people wouldn't know the answer to that.
Sure. We'll set the baseline as around 1980 is when this took place. 82, literally. So what did I made probably $25,000, and I got a 30% raise. And then on top of that, so you get 30%, that's 35,000 ballpark. On top of that, they said, well, you are a nuclear trained officer. There's very few of you. We really have a shortage of you because so many folks left at the end of the Vietnam War. And this is in the middle of the Cold War. We were going to sea all the time to counter Russia, the Soviet Union at the time. Oh, anyway, we got a $6,000 bonus. Starting with 25, you get 8,000, 8 plus. You get 6 more, well over halfway, 50%. And I qualified for a mortgage, you know, and so now I have a wife, didn't have any children then. I have a place, I can actually buy a home. So you can, you know, one could work through inflation and get your way up there. Today, I'm very happy to say that a law was put in place around 1995 that said, look, pay and allowances, which take care of if you're a pilot, or you're a tank driver, or an Air Force pilot, something like that. They take into account what you do, and they compare it with somebody with a similar education, in other words, a peer, and say, what is an appropriate salary for you, or total benefits? Now, there's base pay, there's the monetary aspect, but like in the civilian community, compensation is broader than that. So they take into account the fact that you get free health care. They take into the account that they are paying into investing on your behalf a deferred pension plan, which after you retire, you say, oh, I didn't realize that this would really be worth. So these things all, when you look at them, I say, okay, it's good. It's competitive, for lack of a better term. And then your decision to, I think, maybe the bottom line of your question, is it really all about money? It isn't. The last comment I would make in this case, we in leadership spent a lot of time saying, why are people leaving? And said, I know, we need to give them a raise. And actually they're saying, no, how about I'm going to see all of the time if I'm in the Navy or deploying all the time, one. Two, even when I'm back, I'm working so hard to prepare to deploy the next time, I'm not seeing enough of my family, and it's really wrecking my family life. Or lastly, I just don't find it satisfying because of whatever, fill in the blank.
Admiral, for anyone who doesn't know what a tour is or how long it lasts or how do you get like where the base is or how are you sent out, can you just talk a little bit about that process? I think that would be like interesting for the listeners to know about it.
Yeah. So let's take a 30-year-old person. They've been through pilot training, if that's it, or in my case, nuclear training, the school and all that processing. So now they are kind of a notional officer at the age of 30. And you say, all right, you're going on a quote-unquote tour. Let's say you're going to go to sea. Well, where are our ports? Well, they're in the Seattle area on the East Coast. Norfolk is a major base. San Diego, Hawaii. Mayport, Florida, which is very close to Jacksonville, that area. There are smaller, but those are the big picture ones. You would go there. You would live there. It's a high-cost area because if you think about any of those areas, a lot of development, a lot of homes on the water and all that. So they tend to be high cost. But number two, if your spouse or your family are professionals, they too can find something to do. Attorneys, teachers, you get my point. So that's a good thing. If you're in the Army, you go to a fort and they tend to be inland and they tend to be in the Midwest a lot, Texas, West Texas. It's a little more difficult for them. Air Force, similarly, they have Air Force bases have a name, but they tend to be where you can get a long runway and you can get away from a high concentration of folks. Why? Because you're flying planes and you need to stay out of flight patterns. So these are the things that enter into it. I would say, especially as I stand back, a Navy career brings you closer, if you will, to many of your peers, both in where you are. It's good for your family. And I'm not selling one versus the other because they all have advantages here and there. But it's harder to make a living for a more junior officer. When you go there, it's about 3 years that you are in this quote unquote assignment. It's usually involved with I'll call it a platform. It could be a ship, a submarine, an aircraft carrier. It can be a squadron of jets. How many are in a squadron of jets? 15 or 20 jets, and they are or propeller planes. Or you would be in a battalion of soldiers. A battalion has roughly 400 to 500 people on average. So hopefully that gives you kind of a little bit of context.
In the military, the concept of mission clarity is paramount. How can business owners adopt a similar mindset to stay focused on their goals and navigate uncertainty?
Thank you for that question. Since I've retired, I'm not a business person, so I'll say that right up front. And I don't pretend to understand business, but I've watched things. And I am personally amazed at how difficult it is for large and sometimes around medium, I've really never saw a small organization, to plan strategically, to look beyond, in some cases, the next shareholder meeting or to two shareholder meetings and say, well, where do we want to be in 5 years? And who is working on that? It's left to the C-suite, sometimes the CEO or the COO in this very high-level group who they get caught up in stuff, and they, if not contaminated, they're certainly influenced by their own reality. And so then they may turn to a consultant firm, but they don't know your business. They just don't know your business. And they're going to tell you what somebody else did. So I think you really have to determine what got us here, what works well, and you have to communicate it over and over and over again with the clarity you mentioned. When I took the job, my last job as head of the Navy, I said, I want to really simplify where I want the Navy to go. I know I'm going to have a limited budget because that's where we were going, in this case, in the Obama administration. So I've worked through that, and I used what I thought were 8 words. I said, war fighting first. We're going to operate forward, which means deploy, and we need to be ready. Now, underneath all those, there's a lot to talk about and unpack. It's a great idea to get outside consulting help and to bring in managers to improve you and all that. And say, I'd like to see the background of those that are doing this. They have any idea what we really do here? So anyway, I think there's an element of empathy and then repeated clarity to stay away from clever phrases and aspects. Get away from hip, unless that's your job to be hip, you know, or your product is to be hip and local and, you know, and that the person on the line, if you're producing something, you know, on the floor can understand that and see where they fit in. And that way that leads to what hopefully would be ownership. And then you got nirvana, where you got ownership, because this is our business, right? And that's works great.
And it almost sounds like you were in a CEO-like role, right, within the Navy, right? And those 6 words, that was your core values. That was your core principle that you were instilling in all of the people under you. You talked a little bit about overseeing people, and it's hard to ask them to do stuff that you've never done yourself. Veterans have, you know, very high level of discipline, clarity, like Jolene mentioned. What do you think it was in the training, in the routine, that taught them a lot of these core values, and how do they connect back to the things that you were saying?
The military, the U.S. military foundation is integrity. You say, well, okay, what does that mean? It means that the person speaking to you or doing whatever they're doing with you is giving you the absolute truth. Why is that important? Well, if you're in the cockpit on a F/A-18, a fighter attack Hornet, you're about to go from 0 to 150 miles an hour in 1.3 seconds, and you turn to somebody that's out there, and you may have seen these in movies, and you salute. That means you have turned over everything to that crew who you hope has the steam at the right pressure. You get my point. Because it's all on them. And so you have to trust completely. And everybody there is reporting something like, what's the weight of the aircraft? What kind of landing gear does it have? Because you have to adjust it for that. What is the wind? You get my point. This all has to come in. So set that aside and move to you're in the Army and you're in the Airborne Division. You're about to jump out of the airplane. You say, I wonder who packed this pair of shoes. This is not the time to wonder. You have complete confidence. So you get my point. That's easy. You're about to submerge a submarine. So you say, okay, somebody looked to see that all of the valves that needed to be open were open and making sure the ones that are shut are shut. And that is checked and certified. And those that did all that are right. Because if we submerge and a big enough valve is open, we'll never stop the flooding and we will all die. Then lastly, we'll use the submarine again. It's run by a nuclear reactor. And so before you lift the control rods to energize, if you will, the nuclear reactor, you better get that right. Because, you know, that's, again, not only everybody in the submarine, potentially, that would be, that's a little over drama. But it's also the federal government and all that goes with it. The same story on the Hornet, the American people, you know, taxes, paid $80 million for that, and you have to do it right. So integrity, a trust that is underneath it. We talked about clarity of communications. And I get back to empathy, which we don't talk about enough, I think, in some of our today, and I mean everybody, where we tell people, I want you to go do this, and we're going to do that. Say, you have to have a concept, at least, of what you're asking people to do. And we'll say, well, I'm going to hold everybody accountable. Well, that's a great word. But does that mean you're just going to fire everybody that doesn't do it? But they never understood what you were telling them to do anyway. So then you're going to bring the next people in and fire them. How many people get fired at sporting teams? How many teams fail before you realize the coach or the manager, they don't know what they're doing or they don't know what they're telling them? And the foundation is the integrity.
I love that. I think that every business needs integrity, right? If you're a 500-person company, you need to be a well-oiled machine and trust that everybody's doing their job, because the CEO can't check on all 500 people. And if one or two products get shipped out that are incorrect, somebody may get hurt. It could jeopardize the whole company. So I think that integrity is something that companies should really be paying attention to and learning from you guys.
I'll flip that and say, and everybody needs to be able to look up and say, I really trust that person. I think he or she are looking out for my best interests. I put my best years of my life.
I mean, that kind of brings us to talking about where people from military backgrounds and veterans go after their time served, right? And why they make such good workers, employees, entrepreneurs, business owners, because they come in with that years of integrity, knowing that they can't fail for all the people around them, and that whatever they're putting out there has to be the honest truth. What are you seeing, and what is your advice to anybody who's leaving a military background who wants to join the business world?
Well, my advice to them would be, first, open your aperture. What your problems will be at first, I believe, is you fail to see, well, step one might be, you don't really know what you want to do. Say, okay, well, go ahead, but don't get too hung up on something not being what you thought it was going to be. Two, think about where you want to go, and then just be honest with who you are. Because some folks think, well, I need to transition for who I am, especially if they've been in the military a long time. If it's a 5-year stint, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, you'll be whoever you're probably going to be anyway. Don't forget the elements that we discussed. Always tell the truth. Show up for work. There's a lot, you know, you say, well, you know, you have to have a start, and don't give all that stuff up. And then we're taught in the military, you should study your boss's position because you should aspire to be that. And if you don't aspire to be what your boss is, you should get out, because there's somebody below you that is aspiring to be you and they want to move up. And in the military, you got to be out by 62. That's the absolute latest. But generally speaking, you have so many years to be promoted, and then you are out. Everybody knows a little bit about everybody else's job at some level. There's an element of, if you are out on a ship, or you're down on a submarine, or you're up in an airplane, and there's multiple people, we're all in this together, because ship sinks, we all die. That's an attention getter. So if there's a fire, a flooding, you know, electrical, that or the other thing, everybody has to sort of know how to save the very basics of that. So there's a piece of that. That's what I mean by basic ownership. Even the admin person that maybe types all day or does something else knows how to work a fire extinguisher, do this, do that. Similar thing in an airplane, and then recognize traumatic things.
Admiral, Tell us about some of your mentors when you were growing up that shaped your leadership journey. And what lessons did they leave with you that still resonate to this day?
Well, when I was in my, if you will, second iteration, so I completed what we call the junior officer tour, where you just learn to do things like pilot the submarine or fly an airplane.
Just that?
Well, I mean, that's you're just yourself. I mean, it's your skill as a pilot. So you have to learn how to gather the group together and say, folks, this is the job. And it kind of gets back to, do they all believe me? Do I understand what I'm telling them to do? Well, hopefully, because you flew for a while. So now you're telling pilots how to be a good pilot, and you are a pilot. But then you have to be able to give them direction, clarity of direction, follow up on that. That transition, I had a great guy to help me understand that, realize that how to the key, Bill Belichick and all these people were preparation. And it was, it's a lot of hard work. One, two, you aspire to some position. Say, you know, if I could be this position, if I could be the vice president or the general manager, it's all I want to do. And it doesn't work that way. You know, you don't say, okay, you're the general manager, so life is cool. The rest of the time, I said, no, this really is hard. After that, maybe VP. So he helped me understand this is a lot of hard work, how to be efficient in that work. Very big things. In other words, the term was how to win. And the win was, if you want to go get somebody to do a bunch of maintenance on the submarine, in this case, and you want them to take your job first, not the other one, you got to go up prepared, understand there's hard work to that, because you're doing it on behalf of these people. The second part is the part of family in this. Once again, you're going to go be all this stuff, and you have a family that says, well, we're here to support you. But say, they need to be a part of all this, and they have to be a factor in this. And so this individual said, if this isn't for you, you really should leave. Lastly, tell you, even when folks were admirals, became admirals, when people would say, hey, what's the difference between a two-star general and a three-star general? And the simple answer is solutions. As a two-star general, you have your job. You do what you do, and a lot of times you're defining the problem and how you need more money, people, or time to do the job. You're usually out in the field. Now, the three-star has to come up with solutions. They are generally the CFO. They are generally the head of logistics, the head of personnel. They got to come up with solutions for what this two-star is defined, if this makes sense. And enormously difficult. If the two-star is looking to see, how would I do this? That's a good thing. A better thing than saying, so now I'm in this job, I got an extra star, but my God, the problem. I really wish I had thought about this before. That gets you back to individual productivity and then the unit or the group's productivity and how you manage that. Because you can't do everybody's job.
Do you get the star after the solutions, or how do you get the star?
That's a very good question. You demonstrate your potential, especially in those, I'm talking about executive ranks now. A lot of folks say, this is wonderful, why they got promoted to a third star, and it's like a reward for what, that's actually not how it works at all. It's, I think this person has the potential, and it's not to just go to this rank. It's to go to the job which happens to carry that rank. When we're talking, in this case, two-star to three-star. The last rank that any general, any admiral can, permanent rank, is two-star. Every job after that is a promotion into a job which carries that rank for the duration of the time you're in that job. When that time is up, and it's usually 2 to 3 years, you either get another three-star job or get promoted to a four-star, or you revert back to your permanent rank as a two-star, which if that happens, that generally means I think it's time to retire.
Relating it back to the business world, right? You're a CEO and you've got employees under you, right? You're talking about promoting people based on what you think that they can accomplish in that role, where I would say the corporate structure, you get promoted once you've already demonstrated that you can do that stuff. What you don't see is people getting demoted, right? Which you were just talking about. You know, if people get promoted into these roles and they're not doing a good job, typically they just sit in those roles for year after year, where it sounds like, you know, a three-star general who isn't excelling, you know, does go back down to the two-star significance.
Though they can't stay as a three-star very long because there are limits up or out, remember. So there's a time limit. If they don't do well, they'll be moved early. if they do poorly, they'll be relieved. I've commented, again, it's another observation. I didn't think of that in a previous what have I seen. And that is that people sit at a position for a long time, including CEO. I'm really amazed at people I read about in the Wall Street Journal who are in their late 60s and 70s. I'm thinking, really? How long is this going to go on? There's nobody that could do your job. I mean this in the best sense that is feasible, that I think it is healthy to refresh any organization, because you could be emeritus, you could go to the board, you could be a whatever and look over. But until you wear that position, I was called the vice chief of naval operations. Think of it as just the number two. And I went to almost every meeting my boss did during the day. There were times when the boss was out of town, I had the authority to make the decision, and in this case, his behalf. But I tell you what, and then I went into that job and I said, okay, I've been number two for 2 years. I've seen all kinds of stuff. And I was blown away by it. I said, my, this is very different when you're number one. And so I think it would behoove us in general in every organization that you change out. I'm not talking about term limits, but I think you get my point. There comes a time when I think the individual should say, I think I got this place right where it's working good and it's good. And then you have your personal whatever makes you go. I don't think it's healthy that people sit for long periods of time and don't aspire to do something.
So let me ask you, right, because I know, you know, we're talking about people growing and moving on to, you know, the next role. Some people aren't made for the next role when, you know, maybe not at the higher levels of the military, but the lower levels, when somebody isn't showing promise or excelling, what happens with them?
When you enlist in the military or commissioned an officer, it's a contract for a certain amount of years, depending on what you do. So let's say you're going to be, I'll use a junior sailor, is going to be a nuclear machinist mate on a submarine, nuclear trained machinist mate, and then I'll use a pilot for an officer. The first year and a half of an enlistment would be at school, and you're going to learn how the nuclear propulsion plant works. Then you need the skills of a machinist mate to run turbines and that, but these are on a nuclear submarine. So there's some element of nuclear valves that you will operate and say, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, the fluid going through it is radioactive. That's kind of a big deal. So you better get it right. So yeah, you go through school for a year and a half, and then you go, so, well, wait a minute. I want to get about 3 years out of this person. Okay, well, that's 4.5 years minimum. So it's generally a 5-year total enlistment. So you're under contract. I get, you know, if you pass the school, you're in for, you'll get evaluated during that period. If somewhere around the 4-year point and maybe the 3-year point, you're a promising individual and you say, I like this, my family likes this, I'd like to reenlist in some cases early. So in sports, you know, you get your contract extended, early extension for you. We think you're promising. This does exist there. And that's good for understanding retention. It's good for planning and all that. If not, when you get to your late last, in the last year, you can say, I want to reenlist. If you have served with distinction, for lack of a better term, good, you must be great, then you can reenlist. So another contract. A pilot is almost 9 years, because the first 2 years takes a while to be an effective pilot. And then they say, we know you, the airlines are so hungry because we just did what they would have to do. And so we need some time from you. So people really want to be pilots, but everybody wants to be a pilot. I mean, you see Top Gun, Maverick, and all that. They say, that's what I want to do, or pick your Air Force. And it's exciting if you're 20-some years old. So you'll be done by the age of 28, 29. Some people say, not for me. I got bigger things to do. Fine. And if they don't, then we want to retain that pilot at that point. And then you get bonuses and that. And it's extraordinary. They make good money. They have to be competitive with the airline industry, or that's where they're going to go, because they're going to go to sea on an aircraft carrier in the Navy, or they're going to deploy to not fun places in the Air Force. You know, they're not going to deploy to Italy and hang out. It's generally, you know, in the desert or somewhere where it's either, if not hostile, you're near hostile.
Do you know the ranges on which those competitive rates are?
Well, so let me give you a pilot. A pilot will, when they say, congratulations, you are qualified to be a pilot, you get roughly $40,000. All right, that's just a bonus. That's just for qualifying. You complete pilot training, there's another bonus of about the same amount. So notice I say bonuses. Each year when Congress authorizes and appropriates a bill, like sports bonus, signing bonus, Does it count against the cap? So this doesn't count against salary, base pay. It's different from that. So we manage bonuses, and they can be like, think of them as maybe sub-bonuses. So let's say you are flying a four-engine jet. We have a lot of aircraft. They're basically like 737s. And some look just like a MAX, including the cowling on the engines. A little different in the navigation system, my point. And so you say, very valuable because, of course, transitioning over is you could fly for FedEx, UPS, or you could fly commercial. We really want you to stay. So those bonuses tend to get bigger. The further up you go to a certain point, about age 45, they say, okay, you've been for well over 20 years, 23 years, 45, 46. You're into management now. You're not going to fly very much anyway. So now I want to do is fly. So you may want to leave and the bonuses go down because I really don't, I can get more people into management than a great pilot, if that makes sense. There's a similar aspect in submarines, SEALs, surface ships. So salary, I would say a notional 35-year-old nuclear submariner makes $100,000 to $150,000 a year. I don't know how you put a value on your health care, how you put a value on the pension. And then thirdly, if I send you, remember I told you the Navy are in ports and they tend to be high cost areas. If you move to San Diego, which is a huge jet area, your ability to get your mortgage is going to be outrageous, right? So you get a stipend for housing for you to get a place to live. And that's based on your zip code and the cost of housing in a zip code. And so that gets pretty high versus going to Iowa, and there's an Air Force base in Iowa, that's lower. But you can still buy the home. That makes sense to you. So I can't put an absolute value on that. It tends to be relative values when you get into that.
Let's talk about the other side of it, right? For business owners who are hiring veterans, do you have any tips on how they could maximize the use or efficiency of veterans just based on their experience?
I would say don't underestimate, but they're not all superstars. All right, number one, if they're a officer coming out of the military, understand, I know you can look at their CV and all that. These people are graduate school level folks because they wouldn't promote to even a mid-grade officer, a 38 to 4-year-old person. That's how competitive it is unless they have at least graduate school. So their education is legitimate and it's real and it's not some thing out there in left field. These are really, we don't use military graduate schools per se. We have them for things like acoustics and reactor physics, very specific to the government or the military. But most of our kids go away to any kind of grad. So number one, education. Two, I would really mine or dig into that leadership that they've been exposed to and expect it. Give them a chance. You know, say, I am going to use you for this. I wouldn't farm them off and say, I don't know how they're going to fit in. You may need to get somebody to help you ask the right questions. They're nervous about that transition. You're using two different acronyms. You might say, no acronyms. We're going to talk with each other. We're going to use every word there because I've seen that. And I wouldn't tolerate anything less than the sort of high morals and traits because they shouldn't be slipping from that. Hopefully that makes sense to you.
Admiral, we talk a lot about the idea of sweat equity, about investing in yourself, your mindset, your relationships, your purpose. What does sweat equity mean to you?
I'll try to summarize it with a military term, readiness. Hopefully it'll all make sense to you. Your personal readiness involves, number one, you have to be medically ready. You owe it to your organization, whatever, to show up and work and to be healthy. So you have to get a physical. You have to acknowledge at certain levels, you know, you are invincible. I'll give you that. I don't know when it is, 35, but I told my son at 40, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to you because a lot of this is hereditary because it happened to me, it happened to my dad. So you have to be medically ready and you owe it to the organization. Some people don't get physicals. I don't understand it. They're in every healthcare plan going. All right, one. Two, physically fit. You have to be fit enough to do the job you're in. Everybody doesn't have to be, you know, a hard body going to do this, that, or the other thing. Although, to the extent you do, that sends a pretty good message. A third, it can tend to be their willingness or their ability to be mentally sound. So people got to get sleep. And guess who has to show that example? And then I'm going to take vacation and I'm having a bad day. And usually your chief of staff or your scheduler will say, what are you doing here? Some people in the military where we don't do things well is we don't say, I need to take a day off. Well, you can't take a day off. And say, so you show up, and COVID has helped us through that. And then lastly, there's an element of what I'll call spiritual well-being. And I'm not off in left field, I don't think, here. It could be religion, that's fine. But one needs to, when their mental element is being challenged, and they say, wow, I'm having a really bad day, or you are given a challenge of how do we possibly take this budget to this, or some phenomenon is taking place which is killing your business. You say, how do I go away and think this thing through and calm myself down, intervene, meditate, Zen, religion, and there's a vast majority of it, whatever it turns out to be. I think those things somebody has to, that is going to be in a job of high stress, high tension, or relent. You can say, well, it's not really high tension, but if it's relentless, it's really going to be, it's going to get to you. So I think those four pieces, invest in those things to be, if not the best person you can be, to say you tolerate yourself, but obviously to show an element of humanity to your other people. I'm deeply appreciative. I'm humbled that you would ask me these things. Your willingness to discuss that piece of being a veteran, because I would say when I retired, it was 2015, it wasn't that long after we left Afghanistan and Iraq and the Mideast wars. And a lot of people were, the military downsized a bit, quote unquote. People left. There were a lot of wounded warriors and veterans. And I went through a period the first 3 years, even here at the firm when I came to UBS, saying a veteran is not a wounded warrior. They're not all damaged goods, which would be my, when you hire, because the questions still come out. I don't know about this person. Number one, I know that person has PTSD. I say, not actually, you know, and then TBI, you never know. I don't know. So thank you for that and your willingness to be interested in that experience of a veteran.
It's our pleasure. I feel like I could talk to you a lot longer and go a lot deeper with that part of your life and that part of your careers. I find it so fascinating and just so honorable. So again, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate you sharing your experiences, your stories, your journey with us. And we're really proud to have you as part of the team here at UBS.
Thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.